From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
As the national debate on gun violence continues, some Republicans are showing new openness to gun control measures. One of them is the president, though he seems more focused on the idea of getting guns in the hands of teachers. Will any of this talk lead to Congress doing something? Meanwhile, law enforcement in South Florida is facing more questions about whether they could have done more to prevent the shooting. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. On today's show, we'll look at the question of contagion. Do mass shootings lead to copycats, and how can we cover them in ways that don't encourage that? Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report will join us to discuss the court ruling on gerrymandering in Pennsylvania. How does this change the November election picture? And Simpsons writer Michael Price will take on Ted Cruz's contention that most of the Simpsons family are Republicans. All that, plus the Trump administration's first-class travel trouble and why Rich Lowry doesn't go to CPAC anymore, is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. The mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida continued to dominate the news this week. Florida Senators Bill Nelson and Marco Rubio appeared at a CNN town hall with survivors of the shooting on Wednesday. Rubio announced a number of policy shifts on gun control. He now supports raising the minimum age to buy a rifle from 18 to 21. He's open to a limit on the number of bullets a gun magazine can hold, and he wants something called gun violence restraining orders, which we'll discuss a little bit later. A few Republican senators have said they also support raising the rifle buying age, but others are opposed. President Trump has endorsed the idea, but he's been talking more about arming teachers on school campuses, an idea Rubio, for one, has criticized. And the local sheriff's department in Broward County has been drawing increasing criticism. Scott Peterson, the Broward sheriff's deputy who'd been posted to Stoneman Douglas High, resigned Thursday after reports he'd not even entered the building to respond to the shooting, which Broward Sheriff Scott Israel said was a violation of protocol. So I'd been skeptical of this last week. Now I'm more inclined to think that there really were a number of failures of law enforcement here, things that might have been effective in preventing this shooting if things had been caught earlier.
Definitely. And it just each one of these revelations is wrenching. The FBI missed signs, the police department missed signs. It's not even appropriate to call them signs. I mean, people called and said, he will be a school shooter. He is a danger. And for whatever reason, this was ignored. And then you had this officer on site. And I think we have to have a little humility about this. None of us knows how we would react in a similar situation. But when you put on the uniform, one reason we honor people in uniform, you are making a commitment to risk your own life and limb to try to save the lives of others. And this guy, for whatever reason, did not attempt to engage the killer in those first 6 minutes when it might have made a difference.
But I'd like to step back, if I could, Josh, because I think we all know there's been a kind of learned hopelessness about mass shootings in America. There's this sense of a ritual. It's so grisly. There's a reason to believe that the mass shooting in Parkland has the potential to break the cycle, that it's a different fight. For one, a new generation has emerged in these last days. I mean, there is a power and a passion, the voice of the young, allied with an increasingly mature political movement and infrastructure of gun control groups that can combine with unique moral authority of the kids. I'm not naive. It was very heartening to hear a law enforcement officer, the sheriff, I believe, of Broward County, speak as he did at the CNN town hall about the need for sensible gun control. But I think until a vast majority, we're not going to see truly meaningful change on guns until we force them to with our votes. And while this time feels different, I fear that the outcome may be the same until Republicans who control Congress and so many state legislators start losing elections because of their stance, obstinacy on movement on gun control.
But I don't think there's a reason for hopelessness here. I think a lot of the policy ideas that we look at here, I mean, frankly, you know, the gun control ideas that are out there, things like limiting the size of magazines and that sort of thing, they wouldn't prevent mass shootings. They might reduce the deadliness of some mass shootings. They might make it more difficult for some mass shooters to do what they do. And so you need a combination of policies. You don't want to look just at gun control or just at policing or just a number of these things. There are a number of things that could be done that would sometimes succeed at preventing these events, that would sometimes succeed at making these events less deadly than they are. So I think there's been a tendency to try to frame this as an either-or conversation, which it's not. We need to look at, you know, what may have gone wrong with the sheriff's department. We need to look at what new gun laws we may need. And these things things, you know, if we get them right, we combine them together, they'll reduce the rate of death from these things.
Well, I think one thing, and we talked about this on last week, that there's going to be consensus on and is going to happen is enhanced school security. Two of the most gut-wrenching statements we heard this week, one was from the father of a victim at the event with President Trump, and another was one of the mothers at the CNN event, and they didn't talk about guns at all. They just said, let's make schools safe. And I don't think it's plausible to get an armed guard at every school. It'd be highly expensive. And part of the failure here might be that if you're one of these officers, you're basically standing around bored all the time. It's like being an air marshal, except for all of a sudden in a 4-minute interlude, everything is on you. But you're not used to anything happening, so it's hard to react. But many interlocking doors, just making it harder to get into schools, will make a difference at the margin. And I also think so often in these cases, you have all these warning signs, and they sort of go out, you know, Virginia Tech, oh, we're expelling this kid, and we're worried about him, he's dangerous, we're going to expel him, not thinking about him anymore. Who's really in charge? And I think one thing the president can do is appoint a law enforcement task force that does nothing except for focus on this the way we focused on organized crime or on gang violence, and really appoint someone smart and adept and give them a lot of resources to focus on this and bringing people together on these identifying these threats and attempting to neutralize them before they create, you know, these massacres.
I'm not talking about hopelessness, Josh, but I am talking about there's a broken politics regarding guns. It's a, you know, the force of money and political organization will only be overwhelmed when I think you have high intensity voters who are voting on an issue. The politicians, Republican politicians, are for the most part still enthralled to the NRA, which ratchets up its rhetoric. And I do think Rich is right when he says at the margins. I mean, when you have a president who's basically parodying the shibboleths of Wayne LaPierre of the NRA about arming teachers, I mean, our society is already hypermilitarized. The police chief of Tucson, I mean, people who are on the front lines using guns responsibly, believe this is a lousy, lousy idea.
What do
the hardening of, you know, barriers, things like that, but to start arming teachers?
I think it's something actually we really shouldn't have a national debate about. You should have a school district debate about it. And most places in the country are never going to do it. You're not going to do it in urban areas, not going to do it in suburban areas. But in some rural areas, it's something that might make sense, where there's a deeply embedded gun culture, where you're likely to have teachers who are very comfortable with guns and could go through the training and would be comfortable with having that responsibility. There are places in Texas that are already trying this, but it's not high on the list of my priority list.
What do you make the president making it the center of the conversation for them? Because when he talks about hardening schools, he's talking about something very different than what you're talking about. In fact, he explicitly said that, you know, you can't just have defensive measures. You need offensive measures. And he was talking that you might want as many as 40% of teachers in schools packing heat.
It's not going to happen. And he doesn't have the power to make it happen because we don't have a federal school system. So this is, it's, you know, it's the typical, I've used this phrase over and over again, kind of barstool theorizing from the president of the United States. And at times this week, he's clearly just been throwing out all sorts of ideas. Now, one that has a little traction is raising the age where you can buy a rifle to age 21. I'm very skeptical of that idea, and I very much doubt it's going to happen because there's a geographic and class bias in it.
And one, also, it's like the last person who met with the president, I think Geraldo Rivera, proposed that. I mean, it reminds me, it's like the last person who's spoken to the president is what he's saying.
There are a lot of people who are advocating it.
It's not barroom. It's not just barroom stool stuff when the president is basically mainlining and mainstreaming an NRA talking point, which has been a distraction from what truly needs to be done. And the idea of teachers armed and rushing, and I mean, you know, even gun owning teachers were horrified by this idea, and it adds to the dangers. Police who understand you need restraint, to bring this up is recklessly irresponsible.
But I don't think it's
now there are measures that need to be taken, and if there will be limits on bump stocking and you know, age limits that increase, but you could see at the CNN town hall the unmaking of Marco Rubio and the unmaking of others like him who just lack authenticity as they talk about what they're going to do.
Well, I think he's a pleaser, you
know, panderer,
clearly.
I don't think the
ideas that he bent on are unreasonable. I mean, most of them I wouldn't support. This 21, I was going to say in the 21, the problem is you have, you know, huge swaths of the country are rural areas where hunting is part of the culture, and you're not going to wait to do that until you're 21. And two, we tend to forget, In most of the country, you graduate high school and you are an adult. You know, you move out on your own. Mm-hmm. You might have a girlfriend. You might have a wife. You might have a baby. You have a job. You pay taxes. And the idea they're not going to be able to own any sort of firearm, not just to hunt, to defend yourself and your home and your family, it's not going to fly.
You could have said that about the drinking age in 1980, and yet we raised the drinking age from 18 to 21. To 21. I mean, there are a number of things.
There's an inherent right to self-defense. And if you're in a home with a family and you're 19 years old, and just because you're not having extended adolescence in college means you don't have this this right that any adult in America has, I think is wrong.
You know, someone once said change comes slowly, then it comes quickly. There is a possibility here. I mean, you know, what Rubio said when he has to be held accountable to it, I think it was the town hall environment, which moved him to say things to pander. But I mean, on the gun violence restraining orders, it's a measure popular among gun control advocates. But I think you get more and more sheriffs like the one from Broward County, and you could see a critical mass. But again, I come back, it is the voter intensity. We have an election coming up. If this can be lifted up, combined with a younger generation and the registration efforts they're going to make are fairly serious. I mean, it's combined not just marching, but voter registration of people who can vote this election cycle will be very important.
Let's talk about these gun violence restraining orders, because this, as Katrina notes, this is an idea that had been popular on the left, but it's gaining some traction on the right as well, including in your magazine, Rich. David French has been writing about it. Right. What is this idea?
So you'd have family and friends with the ability to petition a judge and say, we'd are aware of someone who is troubled and dangerous and shouldn't be allowed for some definite period to possess or purchase a firearm. And the attraction of it to folks like me, I'm just skeptical of these broad sweeping gun control measures are going to make a difference when the real problem is a specific subset of people getting these weapons. And I think if you had this kind of process in Parkland, I have 100% confidence someone would have used it, because a number of people who are dropping a dime on this guy who are really worried about them, they just would have gone to the judge. And it also, it's a process that is in accord with an individual right to buy arms, because there's due process involved. You know, you can show up and say, no, I'm not really troubled. Now, this kid, whether he would have showed up or not, he wouldn't have been able to make a compelling case, and at least he wouldn't have been able to legally obtain a firearm to carry out this act. It's the single most promising idea I've heard over the last week, and one that has potential bipartisan and trans-ideological
appeal. But the reality is that in most states right now, law enforcement officials often can do nothing to prevent even an obviously troubled person from buying guns, let alone take steps to take guns that person might already own. So there's work to be done.
It makes me think about this one story about the shooter here, which is that shortly, both of his parents are dead. And shortly after his mother died, he moved in with friends of the family, and the police were called because he had threatened them, saying that he was going to go away and come back and get his gun and shoot them. And obviously making a threat like that is a crime. This was not in Broward. This was in Palm Beach. So we're talking about the Palm Beach sheriff here. So the Palm Beach sheriff responds, and the family member he's staying with doesn't want to press charges about it. So there's nothing for the sheriff to do. This is an area where, you know, they didn't want to send Cruz to jail. The gun violence restraining order would have given that family an opportunity to go through some other legal process that would have enabled them to try to have his guns taken away without having him in prison. So that's what makes me think that might have made a difference here. These are already the law in California. They have been for a couple of years. So we'll have, you know, soon we'll have more information about how that's been working in California.
I think California, Washington State, and Oregon, I believe, and Connecticut. And it's a tool. And it's a tool that it's been introduced, I think, in 12 states this year. And it's in a situation like this where the person seems to be a substantial risk to himself or others. It could be like, take a time out, take the guns out of his hand.
Well, that might be a promising idea. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation to talk about copycat effects and a theory on why mass shootings are up, even as violent crime overall is down. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. One confounding fact about mass shootings is they've been getting more common and more deadly over a period when violent crime overall has been falling. And many of the factors that get proposed as drivers of mass shootings, such as widespread availability of guns and violence in the media, were also present back when mass shootings were less common. Our next guest is Ari Shulman, editor of The New Atlantis. He's been writing periodically for The Wall Street Journal about a possible driver of the rise in mass shootings. It's called contagion. Similar to an effect seen with suicides, where high-profile suicides can lead to an increase in suicide, Ari writes about research into self-fulfilling mass shootings, where shooters are inspired to copycat high-profile attacks, and he has some suggestions about how to stop the contagion. Welcome, Ari.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's the evidence here that a certain style of coverage and publicity around these attacks is leading to more attacks?
There's evidence of several different kinds. Some of it is just the fact that mass shootings have been rising and becoming much more frequent, as you mentioned, as gun violence has gone down. I think the better evidence is that when you study the lives of the mass shooters and the materials that they leave behind, they are all obsessed with each other. The Newtown shooter spent years obsessively studying prior shooters. A lot of them are particularly obsessed with the Columbine shooters. That seems to have been a really big driver in this effect. There was a kind of iconography from the videos in the school that many later shooters obsessed over. It's become a kind of template. Basically, there's this idea out there, if you're an angry, frustrated young man, there is an idea out there of how you can go and take your rage out there, out on the world. At some point, somebody started this. It didn't exist before, but now it's there, and more people are imitating it and copying it.
You also talk about a couple of studies that look at the period immediately after mass shooting, showing that there's even a particular effect in the couple of weeks following a shooting.
Yeah, so there's still some dispute among the researchers about how to think about this. I think it's useful to divide this into an infamy effect and a contagion effect. The infamy effect is much more conscious and planned, and I think that is something that you see more in the really, really high fatality mass shootings, and those are people who plan these events over months or years. But I think that there are lower fatality shootings that are more common, where it's much more impulsive. This story is out there in the headline, and other people are suddenly triggered to go out there and do this, in much the way that, you know, we saw the story recently about how there was a rise in suicides after Robin Williams committed suicide. There were similar studies after Marilyn Monroe committed suicide, and this happens after celebrities. There's a similar effect. So some of it is more impulsive, and some of it is more more planned and deliberate.
So, Rich and Katrina, what do you make of this? I mean, both of you run publications. Do you think about the way that coverage of these impacts the way that people might think about it if they're considering making an attack like this?
We're not really the mass media in that way, but I totally think Ari is correct about this. And the wall-to-wall coverage, especially on TV, is in effect an advertisement for evil for a very, very small segment of deranged people. Now, I don't know what you do about that. I think one thing we can do, and this, you know, will seem piddling given the enormity of these events, but I think as a public service, public communications campaign around shooters who have been foiled or were troubled in considering this and were caught and stopped and helped beforehand, you know, doing a 60-second tearful spot about, I was in this dark place and I considered doing the most infernal thing you could possibly imagine. I'm so grateful that someone stopped me and helped me. Things of that nature to countervail the enormous attention that comes to the perpetrators of these events, I think would be helpful, again, at the margins.
No, I think Ari, in fact, brings up that there's a damping effect on suicide from reports about people who considered it but found help instead. And reporters might find similar stories to tell about would-be mass shooters who reconsidered. I mean, voluntary media restrictions, and Rich is right. I mean, what we do at The Nation is not the kind of sensationalistic tabloid coverage that does infiltrate and fill so much of the media space after these. You try to bring attention to the systemic issues, to the moving forward, how to think about it. But there is a precedent. I mean, courts and journalists, as Ari writes, recognize an overriding public interest in protecting the privacy of sexual assault victims and minors involved in crime. And there's almost a public safety argument that could be made that could trump not the public right to know, but the sensationalistic coverage, which I think Ari makes a good case, play a role in contagion. Trying to understand as opposed to sensationalize is something I think would be of value for media generally. You got it. One thing that struck me is the social media. I mean, that's really a new, not that new, but it's a major factor. And how does one put even, you know, voluntary restrictions on social media, which is really becomes out of control at moments like this?
Yeah, that's a really hard question to answer, and I don't have a great answer for it. I will say, just to specify a little bit, as a model of like what not to do, you look at the way that NBC News handled it when the Virginia Tech shooter sent them this manifesto video that he made. That's essentially like broadcasting a propaganda video from North Korea. It has very little informational value, and it allows the shooter to control the kind of messaging of the event. It's a public spectacle. They're trying to create this spectacle of rage and violence. And so I think that the ways that you try to counter that are to think about not playing into the shooter's deliberate messaging.
What role do you think video games play? Because that's an ongoing dispute argument. I think some of the mass shooters have had intricate, intimate relations with what is, and I'm sure many people understand, is one of it outflanks Hollywood in terms of being a major industry, and especially among young men.
I see maybe a weak relationship there. There are some mass shooters who did obsessively play the first-person shooter games. It's hard for me to think that it really made a very big difference. Mm-hmm. I think that they're obsessing over actual acts that happened created the real ideation that was necessary for them to start planning these out as deliberate acts.
That's interesting.
So what would be examples of a cultural idea like this burning itself out or getting ground down by the forces who want to stop it?
Well, I don't know how applicable this is, but there was a phenomenon very similar to this in Malaysia that started, I don't know if anybody really knows when it started, but it was noticed by Western voyagers, I think Captain Cook in the 1700s. It was basically the same as the rampage killing that we have now, but it was done with machetes. It was called running amok. That's where we get the term running amok. And it was sort of the same idea. Somebody enters a kind of frenzy state or has this rage, and they acted out in this way. And it did burn itself out eventually. It kind of stopped happening by the early 1900s. I don't know offhand exactly what the factors in that were, but you can see something sort of similar in serial killing, which doesn't happen nearly as often now in the United States as it used to. I think that there needs to be more attention and study to what causes these things to burn themselves out. I don't know that there's a simple answer to that, though.
You wrote about one interesting example from Vienna in the 1980s about how there was an epidemic of suicides in the Vienna subway, and there was a particular set of standards that media started following there that seems to have been successful in snuffing out that epidemic.
Right, yeah, so that's a good example. So, so there was this rash of suicides in Vienna in the 1980s, people jumping onto the subway tracks and killing themselves. And it was similar to this in a way. It kind of came out of nowhere. It seems like somebody just got the idea to do this at some point. And then the media started covering it in this very sensationalized and even a very romanticized sort of way, where for people who were depressed, it seemed like a way to kind of give their lives meaning in this tragic final act, which I think is basically what mass shootings are. And eventually psychological researchers realized this, and they asked the local media to start reporting these in more clinical ways, not put them on the front page. I think they asked them not to use the word suicide in the headline. Basically to just kind of tone it down, put it a little bit further in and report on it in a clinical way that didn't play into the idea of this as being this grand and tragic act. And the suicides dropped by about 50% pretty quickly.
And so I've been interested, you wrote about this for the Wall Street Journal in 2013, and then you wrote again just a few months ago about coverage of mass shootings, and it looked like there'd been some change over the last few years in the way news organizations are approaching these. It sounds like some of them are adopting what you might call best practices about how to cover these in a way that reduces the risk that they will glorify mass shooters and encourage copycats.
Yeah, there has been some change. I think Anderson Cooper for the last few years has been not naming mass shooters. Ben Shapiro made a similar announcement just a few days ago. And there have been a few other examples like that. I think these are mostly exceptions rather than the norm. And my experience when I've been writing and talking about this has been that journalists are really resistant to this idea. They take it as blaming the media for mass shootings. And of course, the NRA basically released a video a day or two ago arguing that it's the media's fault for mass shootings. And so you can understand why people, particularly in the media, might not be receptive to this idea. I think it's really important not to frame this as something where the media is to blame, but to just recognize that they have a role in this, that in a sense, it's like publishing the template for a bomb or the details of how to carry out a terrorist attack. It is a script for how to create this violence again, and you're putting it out there and enabling other people to do it again. So there are these little glimmers. There are a few little media groups who are starting to think and talk about what the best practices might be, but it's just small glimmers at this point.
Ari Shulman, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Still with me here are on the left, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine and Rich Lowry of National Review on the right. It is CPAC right now, the major conservative conference outside Washington, D.C. And I'll note, Rich Lowry, you're not there. You're here in New York. Why aren't you at CPAC?
I haven't been there the last couple of years, and it's in part because it's harder for me to go down for 4 days for family reasons, but in part because I find CPAC less compelling than I used to.
I would imagine you would, because the kind of conservatism the National Review, to a large extent, has championed is not on display at this operation. I mean, you have a president in the White House who's not your cup of tea, and it's kind of a collection of grievances and conspiracy theories. I mean, your magazine even took this on the other day. Kevin Williamson had a piece about enough with the rancid conspiracy theories. Now, it's not unique to the right, but still, it's been an ugly period, especially the CPAC convention coming in the wake of the Parkland mass shootings.
Well, CPAC's always been, has fringy elements always. And the, I mean, that's true, I think, of any really highly partisan or ideological gathering that has attempts to have some mass appeal. But the temptation at all these events is to play to the crowd. And it's what a lot of talk radio does. It's what a lot of CPAC does. And there's just a fear of airing the intra-conservative debate about Trump. And there is one. So you'll see these justifications of inviting Milo Yiannopoulos, who was disinvited, or inviting Marine Le Pen. It's just, these are just voices on the right, and we deserve to hear them. Whereas you're not going to invite, say, my colleague David French to make the case why presidential character matters the same way we thought it mattered in the 1990s, because you're afraid of offending people. So offending the right people is trolling that they enjoy, which is like inviting Le Pen, but actually challenging and potentially offending some of the core audience is something that's out of bounds.
But tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, it seems to me that since Reagan, we've been on a descent in terms of a true alignment between, say, a White House and the conservative movement, and that at almost every CPAC convention in the last few years, Ron Paul
yeah.
would win the
well that
the,
was
the straw poll,
yeah, that was
poll
the
which
kids.
Was a yeah, yeah the kids but that the kids are the future too.
That was the kids. I mean, CPAC yeah. when I was growing up it was all old people, you know, sort of creaking around and wearing funny hats, and then it, amazingly enough, sort of became a cool thing with kids. I don't know how that happened, but they were all libertarians. And this flip did happen at CPAC, where time runs together for me now. 2 or 3 years ago, Trump didn't go because it would have been a hostile audience, and largely because of the power of partisanship, now he owns the place.
But so, a few years ago, I would have described CPAC as being increasingly fringy and sort mm-hmm. of a show of, like, the weird out there elements of the conservative movement. But you take someone like Sebastian Gorka,
right.
who the Daily Beast had a story this week about how Sebastian Gorka, even though he's been fired from the Trump administration, is a rock star at CPAC. 4 years ago, if Seb Gorka gave a speech, you would have been like, oh, right. weirdo fringe guy. But he was a White House official. A lot of these people who were way out there and yep. you could sort of wave off as not that relevant have now become quite relevant. And I feel like now more than ever, these people are the core of the Republican Party. And someone like Marion Le Pen, you could have brought her for trolling purposes a few years ago. But now, and she represents the more right-wing part of the National Front, unlike the less fascist part of the National Front run by her aunt, Marine Le Pen. She's like mm-hmm. the really extreme ultra-nationalist in France. There's a global movement of these sort of ultra-nationalists, a lot of whom are very sympathetic to Donald Trump.
So I think a couple things have happened. One, again, a couple of years ago, Steve Bannon had this alternative CPAC because he felt his people were being excluded from CPAC, and no one knew Seb Gorka then. I'm not sure whether he was even associated with Breitbart at that time, but he would have been at the alternative CPAC. And what's happened is these people have come in with the tide with Donald Trump, and there's been, conservative mass media, especially Fox News, had given them a big platform because they're very pro-Trump. So all of a sudden, Seb Gorka, who was a marginal figure, 3 years ago, now is a rock star. Now, I'm not sure his rock stardom will be long-lasting, but it is a phenomenon. And there was a video of him, did you see this, confronting a Mediaite reporter?
Oh,
where he nearly, it looked like he was going to slap this guy, you know. So it's just, it's thuggishness, and it's unappealing, and it's wrong.
But, you know, I hate to let the Republican Party off the hook. I mean, there has been an effective hostile takeover by many of these forces. And, you know, even with the resignations, you have a Republican Party which is essentially content with Trump's actions. And they're trying to keep their eyes away from the tweets and the circus atmosphere and the scandals. But they're on board. They're on board. So I don't know where that leaves. I mean, you've made your peace to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, it was a vigorous special issue on the eve of the, in 2016, Never Trump. And it laid out parameters of...
We've gone through phases. We wanted to kill his campaign in the primary and tried the hardest we could. We didn't. We didn't get on board in the general, but we're more hostile to Hillary. And now he's president. He's not going to stop being president. And, you know, ideologically, in terms of what he's actually done, there hasn't been a big Le Penist element to his agenda.
He's walked away from those policies.
It's run in the traditional grooves of Republican policy.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the travel troubles that the Trump administration's been having. There are these stories. EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt has been routinely flying first class for business, which breaks with the ordinary practices for cabinet secretaries. He also seems to always fly Delta. Pruitt's office says it's necessary for him to fly first class for security reasons because of negative interactions he's had with the public when flying coach, which feels like you'd be better off offering no explanation than saying that. Meanwhile, Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin was heavily criticized in an Inspector General report over a trip to Denmark and England, where he brought his wife along and spent several days sightseeing. His chief of staff resigned after the IG found she'd falsified an email in an effort to justify bringing the secretary's wife along on the trip. Also, Don Jr.'s been in India, mixing business and politics, giving a speech on foreign policy while also promoting a real estate project in India. The funny thing to me is, you know, Tom Price got caught up in a scandal like this, the HHS secretary, mm-hmm. and he had to resign. But it feels like nobody really cares that much about these particular scandals. And there's been a sense, you know, why are Trump administration secretaries doing this? Probably because of a sense that they can get away with it. And so far, that's been true.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a natural human temptation. If you can easily ride in first class rather than coach, you're going to find an excuse to do it. And that seems to be what's going on here. It's something that needs to be policed. It should be policed within the administration. It should be policed by people complaining from the outside. But the David Shulkin thing is you know, appears to be a level of corruption beyond that, where the record was falsified to try to cover his tracks when he took his wife for no good reason on this European trip.
This is ugly. I mean, to me, what matters is also that at a time when these same officials have proposed dramatic cuts in their agencies that they're overseeing, they're living it up. And I think the EPA's in-house watchdog is stretched too thin, whatever that means. I mean, cuts, et cetera, to expand its probe of Pruitt's travel. I would put Don Jr. in a separate category, Josh, because I think there you see the ongoing commingling of the public and the private, of Trump business, and the business of the government. I mean, there's a word for this. I think it's oligarchy, plutocracy. I'd like to believe we're a democracy, but the commingling is something that I think has made everyone now an expert on the emoluments clause, but it's pretty crass. And it's kind of stunning that perhaps there's so many outrages that it doesn't provoke more.
Well, now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Katrina Vandenhoevel, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So this is Jack Royer, who's a reporter and anchor for CBS Birmingham, Alabama. 5:45 p.m., Supreme Court issues temporary stay. 8:45 p.m., temporary stay lifted. Execution proceeds. 10:05, media taken to holding area next to family and attorneys. 11:35, execution called off. Quote, not enough time to prepare inmate. They probably couldn't find a vein, 11:50, the lawyer. This is a case in Alabama. 61-year-old Doyle Ham's been on death row for 31 years. There was a 11th Circuit stay. It was lifted. The Supreme Court said, go ahead. Man, they can't find a vein because he has cancer. And I think the barbarism of death penalty becomes very vivid when the lethal injection fluids and the intravenous needle can't be used. And so they've now moved into another day of torture. I'm for life without parole. I think the death penalty is barbaric, and the tweet lays it out by this reporter and anchor for CBS Birmingham.
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
I feel terrible because my tweet does not have anything like the gravity of the one Katrina just highlighted. One of the advantages of Twitter, it makes it possible for you to reach out and touch and otherwise people you would never encounter in real life. And for me, I'm a huge Yankee fan. The season's about to begin. There's this Yankee outfielder prospect named Clint Frazier, who's at the moment probably the sixth outfielder on the depth chart, but is going to make his best college try. And he tweeted the other day, ready, meaning ready for spring training. And I tweeted, make it impossible for them to ignore you, bro. And he tweeted back to me, he replied, I will. So I'm a Clint Frazier fan for life.
My tweet comes from Susan Simpson, who is an attorney in Washington, D.C. She was tweeting about the new indictment against Paul Manafort and Rick Gates. And she says, y'all, I'm dying. Manafort created an incriminating paper trail because he needed someone to help him convert a Word document to PDF. And yes, this is in the complaint. Paul Manafort emails Rick Gates a falsified income statement he's using to apply for a mortgage, the prosecutors say, and he asks Gates to turn it from a Word document into a PDF. Paul, save as PDF is under the print function. There's no need to add a new criminal conspiracy when you're just trying to change a document format. I've been talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Rich Lowry of National Review. I'll be back with Simpsons writer Michael Price to discuss Ted Cruz's claim at CPAC that most of the Simpsons family are Republicans. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On Thursday at CPAC, Senator Ted Cruz said this in an interview with Ben Domenech, publisher of The Federalist.
I think the Democrats are the party of Lisa Simpson. And Republicans are happily the party of Homer and Bart and Maggie and Marge.
Simpsons showrunner Al Jean responded on Twitter saying Cruz claimed Maggie's support, but he's the one who should have a pacifier in his mouth. But I'm not sure Cruz is wrong. We do know that Marge Simpson has a history of voting Democratic. Lisa reminds her in one episode that she voted for Jimmy Carter twice, a fact Marge seems embarrassed about. But the Simpsons are, demographically, exactly the sort of white working class family that would have moved toward Republicans in the Trump era. To discuss that, I'm joined now by Michael Price, who's one of the writers for The Simpsons. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Josh. Great to be here.
So how would you characterize the politics of the Simpsons family?
Well, first of all, I'll say this. In the Simpsons world, these are the only really known Republicans. We have several episodes where we set at the Republican headquarters in Springfield, which is a dark, evil castle. So the only Republicans that are known in the Simpsons universe are Mr. Burns, the evil billionaire who is in league with Satan and tried to block out the sun, Sideshow Bob, a multiple attempted murderer and former TV clown who rigged an election to win for mayor, and Dracula, the Prince of Darkness. Our Democrats that we know of are Mayor Quimby, Lisa, you know, I know that Marge voted for Jimmy Carter. And we have a character based on Arianna Huffington, whose name is Adriatica Vell Johnson, who, in a joke I wrote 11 years ago, summed up, I would say, probably our writer's view of the Democrats sometimes, is that it was an election that seemed like a sure thing for the Democrats. And she said, this looks so great. I don't know how we will blow it, but we will, because that's what the Democratic Party is all about. So that's sort of the writer's view of life in general is sort of we like to go after both sides. If you want to talk about the family specifically, I can go into that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so Ted Cruz has laid this claim. I think a lot of Simpsons fans, especially Democratic Simpsons fans, have been a little offended by it.
Well, I'd say this. Lisa is clearly a Democrat. She talks about it all the time. She also is an avid NPR listener and supporter. But she's also the smartest Simpson, the most compassionate, the most intellectual, the most artistic. And if our predictions are correct, we did predict, after all, that Donald Trump would be the president, that Lisa will be our next president, having inherited a terrible mess from her predecessor. If you look at Homer, I'm not so sure. You know, I saw a lot of reactions to this on Twitter yesterday that, you know, Senator Cruz would want Homer in the Republican Party. You know, he's a lazy, ignorant, you know, child-strangling drunk, you know, who we write him, there's a really famous quote from one of our former writers that said that we tend to write Homer as if he's either like a giant baby or a dog who falls victim to his whims, who gets everything, all his information from television, and his opinions are based on the last thing he heard. So, you know, maybe he is a Republican, or at least he's a Trump Republican in that way.
Well, so it's interesting to me that, well, first of all, there's an episode where Homer says, "I usually think people who vote are a little bit fruity," which suggests that maybe he was not so politically active in any direction.
I don't think I don't think he's super politically active. I think he voted for like which M&M color should be next.
It's interesting to me the way the show portrays the Democratic Party focusing around the character of Diamond Joe Quimby, who is this sort of this, you know, Northeastern-style corrupt machine Democratic politician, which feels a little archaic in the way that the Democratic Party has gone sort of more upscale and more diverse
in the
last few decades.
In our defense, so is the show. we're going into season 30 right now. So, yeah. But, yeah.
But, I mean, part of the way Trump has won over a lot of former Democratic voters is that he appeals to a lot of the sort of people who long voted for Democrats who were in some way similar to Joe Quimby.
Yes, that's true. That's true about Trump, I'd say. That's part of the reason why he won the Electoral College. You know, I just don't know. As far as we write the characters, you know, I think that Homer is sort of apolitical and that he goes back and forth. I mean, the only times he's actually voted in our show were in two Halloween episodes where in one of them he tried to vote for Obama in 2008, but the machine kept changing it to McCain, and then the machine ultimately ate him. And then in another Halloween show, he voted for either Kang or Kodos. I think it was Kodos, the aliens who came over and took over the bodies of Bill Clinton and Bob Dole. And then
was Kodos the Republican alien or Democratic alien?
I forget. I just watched that episode this morning. I forget which one was Clinton and which one was Dole, but they were both equally bad. And then they had a quote which sums up, I think, a lot of our feelings about it anyway, which is that the one that was Dole said, you know, it doesn't matter who you vote for anyway, your planet is doomed. That's sort of the way we feel sometimes. You know, so then Homer, the one episode I did write that was very political came out about 10 years ago, where Springfield ended up hosting the first primary in the nation, even before New Hampshire or Iowa, and they were inundated by candidates. And then as a protest vote, everyone decided to vote for Ralph Wiggum. And so I know that Homer voted for Ralph Wiggum for president.
So maybe neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but a Wiggum loyalist.
Absolutely. Absolutely a Wiggum loyalist.
Michael Price, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Back with me are on the left, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. Let's turn our attention to Pennsylvania, where the state Supreme Court imposed a new congressional district map after finding the existing Republican-drawn map violated Pennsylvania's state constitutional guarantee of free and equal elections because it was too gerrymandered. The new map is much less of a squiggly mess than the old one, but it makes subtle choices that favor Democrats. For example, one new district takes in a swing county outside Philadelphia and combines it with the Democratic city of Reading, when it could just as easily have picked up conservative Amish areas near Lancaster. Democrats point out the map still has only 8 districts won by Hillary Clinton, compared to 10 that Trump carried. To discuss the House map in Pennsylvania and nationally, we're joined now by Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. What does this map mean for Democrats' national chances of taking the House back in November?
Yeah, this map is a lot better than I think even the most optimistic Democrats had thought it could be. Our expectation going into the redistricting and into the lawsuit was that, you know, Democrats might improve their chances in a couple of districts. In this case, it looks like they have an opportunity really to pick up 4 districts, and potentially the map would go from one that's right now 13 Republican, 5 Democrat to evenly split, 9 Democrats, 9 Republicans. It at least puts one district that was already in significant danger, one you alluded to. There's a suburban Philadelphia district that was held by Pat Meehan, who is retiring after his, shall we say, interesting relationship with the woman in his office who he said was his soulmate. He retired. The seat was already in danger. Now it went from a slightly Democratic leaning to overwhelmingly Democratic leaning. And there are a couple other suburban Philadelphia area districts that also got significantly better for Democrats. So all in all, big news. Remember, Democrats, good news for Democrats. They need 24 seats to take control of Congress. If they pick up 4 here, right, they're getting close.
And I think Democrats think they have a shot at picking up as many as six in a decent environment.
Right, in a really big year. Yeah.
So I guess this sort of raises a question of what it means for a congressional map to be fair. Because I think what Democrats would say in defense of this map is that basically, you know, Pennsylvania is an evenly split state. Donald Trump just barely won it. And so you ought to have a map that has about an evenly split number of districts that lean Democratic, lean Republican. And you'd get members elected from Pennsylvania in about proportion to the way people vote statewide for Congress. Right. Now, if you drew a map that was just designed to be as compact as possible, you know, not breaking county lines and drawing sort of the most, you know, logical looking districts you could, you'd probably get a somewhat more Republican map than this one. And the reason for that is that Democrats are just so concentrated in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh. If you draw those compact seats, you get a couple of places where Democrats win by 60 plus points.
Right.
And then you might have, you know, say 11 districts or 10 or 11 that would tend to favor Republicans. And I guess these are both theories there of how a congressional map should be drawn. It's not clear to me that either one is intrinsically correct. This is a subjective right. question about what the right way to elect a legislature is.
So I do think this is the fundamental challenge for Democrats overall, which is they simply are too highly concentrated in urban and inner suburban areas and in college towns. And this is where the Supreme Court is going to have to weigh in on this idea of cracking and packing, right? Is it fair to keep a community of interest together? Yes. What if that community of interest votes 90% for one party over the other? And that means that that's one district that has basically almost all of its votes wasted versus four districts around it that become competitive or lean toward the other party. So gerrymander is essentially in the eye of the beholder, and the court, the Supreme Court, is going to help us potentially decide if there are, you know, real fundamental legal ways in which you can define what a gerrymander is.
I would say a couple things. One, of course, gerrymandering helps Republicans, but it's really human geography that gives them, I think, the lion's share of their advantage in the House in terms of they're going to win more seats than you would think just based on their share of the national congressional vote. Two, for Republicans, there's going to be an element of hypocrisy here, since for 40 years, from 1954 to 1994, Democrats had a lock on the House with an enormous help from partisan gerrymandering. So this is, I think it's endemic to the political process. It has been since the time of the founding. We'll see what the Supreme Court says, but I doubt it's going to be able to come up with any clear, definable line. And this will just continue to be a morass that's now more in the courts than in the political system where it truly belongs.
But Amy, let me ask you, we've seen a wave of Republican retirements. Do you see a wave election at this moment as we sit here on Friday afternoon?
I mean, I definitely see that there is a wave building out there. Everything, I can't remember who pointed it out earlier, but all of the indicators, whether it is on the, I think it was you, Katrina, whether it was, you know, the enthusiasm factor, the elections we've already have shown us that there's a big enthusiasm advantage for Democrats. The fundraising has been impressive at the Senate and House level for Democratic candidates, not so impressive for Republican candidates. Retirements, many more Republicans than Democrats, especially in competitive districts. And then, of course, the president and his standing, which historically has been the best indicator of success or failure for the party in the White House. The president under 50% in a very dangerous place for his party versus a president at or over 50% in a much better place. So all of the empirical data lines up to say that this is going to be a particularly bad year for Republicans. It's just that I think some of these individual districts are going to look different. So we talk about the national vote, but I think what's going to be much more critical and what we're looking at is some of those individual districts, even where Trump won in the last year, whether he's holding up now, whether the coalition that elected Donald Trump is going to turn out, and whether the coalition that turned out but not really enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton is going to be so energized that they're going to take seats that we might not have even put in our calculation earlier. And so I, as a bottom line, Katrina, I would argue that the playing field is a lot bigger than what people are looking at right now. I think you're going to see, as this kind of election suggests, a lot of surprises, either in retirements or people who end up on election night being surprised that they didn't make it.
I want to thank Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
My heart goes out to the kids in Portland. I don't think they should be smeared or mocked the way some folks on the right have done to them. But we should all remember that they are teenagers with no specialized knowledge of gun policy. That some in the media want to make them unassailable experts is the ultimate argument from authority, and as stilted and unconvincing as that fallacy always is.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, what's your rant?
Lockheed Martin, the defense agency, got $35.2 billion from taxpayers last year. That's more than many federal agencies. Think of it this way. Lockheed's government sales are nearly what the Trump administration proposed for the State Department next year in its recently released spending plan. The company's so big that some quip Lockheed's chief executive is more powerful than a cabinet secretary. One defense consultant put it this way. Diplomacy is out. Airstrikes are in. That doesn't make America great again, but it sure rewards defense execs and unnecessary weapon systems.
For my rant, I want to talk about Olive Garden. Do you remember a few years ago there was a Wall Street investment firm that wanted to fire the management at Olive Garden? They said Olive Garden was underperforming in part because they'd strayed too far from Italian food. For example, they stopped salting the water they used to make pasta so they could get a warranty on their pasta pots. Well, that firm actually won the vote. They ousted the board of the company that owns Olive Garden, and they took over the management. And yet Olive Garden is still at it. That Wall Street presentation scolded Olive Garden for serving inauthentic and unhealthy fried foods, like fried lasagna bites. Well, the fried lasagna bites are still on the menu, and in recent weeks they've been joined by pasta nachos and something called a meatball pizza bowl. Guys, what are you doing? You said you would make Olive Garden Italian again. This is why people don't trust Wall Street. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina VandenHeuvel, Ari Shulman, Michael Price, and Amy Walter. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.